It is a common call in American society to yell out power to the people. The call gets a bit louder when people feel like government does not hear or respond to their concerns. Over time, quite a few mechanisms for choosing people for office have democratized in our country. And that could be part of the problem, say our guests for this hour. Francis McCall, Rosenbluth, and Ian Shapiro are the authors of the book Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. The book makes the case that stronger, not weaker, political parties would help improve things. Francis McCall, Rosenbluth, and Ian Shapiro are both professors of political science at Yale University. Francis, welcome to you.
Francis is not with us. It's just Ian today.
Okay. Well, good to have you here, Ian. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
So to paraphrase several people, you fix the problems of democracy with more democracy. Is this book a response to that viewpoint?
Yes. It's not so much more democracy as the right kind of democracy. What we have in this country, as in many democracies around the world, is ever more angry and alienated voters being accompanied by reforms that put more power in the hands of voters. Seems like a paradox. It plays itself out differently in different countries, but in the U.S., the real core of the problem is primaries. Now, they've been around for more than 100 years in Congress, but what's changed is that the vast majority of seats are now safe seats. So in over 90% of elections into the Congress, the only election that matters is the primary. And the dirty little secret about primaries is that they have extremely low turnout, and they tend to be people on the fringes of the parties. So you can get someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez elected in New York on an 11% turnout, or Jim Jordan in Ohio, or Mark Meadows in North Carolina, same kind of story. And so then what happens is those people go to Washington, and either they compromise in order to do what you have to do to govern with such disparate parties, or they don't. And if they do compromise, their grassroots activist voters who elected them rightly feel like they've been sold out because they, you know, not doing what the activists sent them there to do. Or if they don't compromise, the rest of the voters see gridlock and dysfunctional parties and lots of finger-pointing. And so they're alienated. So when we say more power to the people, the question you always have to ask is which people? And the basic problem is we have empowered small groups of voters with intense preferences to essentially take hostage of both of the parties from the extremes. And that's why Congress is so much more polarized than the country is.
So you really take it all back to primaries then?
Not all of it, but it's a big piece of it. And say in the presidential side of things, primaries were only really introduced after the 1970s. If you go all the way back to the beginning, the presidential candidates in the early 19th century were actually picked by the congressional leaderships. So they functioned more like a team. It was more like a parliamentary system, if you like. The leadership in Congress would pick candidates that they could work with on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue. And so you got more coherent parties, like more like teams all pulling in the same direction. The first populist assault on that came from Andrew Jackson after he lost to John Quincy Adams in 1824. That's when we first got party conventions, which also were dominated by activists of their own day, and eventually we got primaries from the progressives. But you have a situation like we're living with now, where Donald Trump was actually picked as the Republican candidate by less than 5% of the U.S. electorate. Most people don't know that those primaries, particularly the last dozen or so, had extremely low turnout, some of them single digits.
So what you're saying is that in the previous system, in the prior to the full primary system, Donald Trump wouldn't have gotten to the leadership of his party, let alone to the country.
Definitely not, mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, if the Republicans, under more pressure to democratize, had not put in the rule which said that the superdelegates would be bound by the primary election on the first ballot, they would have stopped Trump, but they couldn't do that. The Democrats now have put in that same rule change, by the way, which was a condition that Bernie Sanders made for supporting the Clinton ticket in 2016, even though the superdelegates had not, in fact, stopped him from getting the nomination.
Ian, before we get to a break, though, I do want to ask one other question, though, because obviously you're pinning a lot of this on primaries. But what about the distorting effect of money in politics? And is that an issue? Because you go to countries beyond just the United States in this book.
Absolutely. So money is a huge problem in American politics. And most people who talk about money in politics focus on the supply of money, the lobbyists and their agendas and what they want, which is a huge problem and has been made worse by the Supreme Court since 1976, when it said money is speech, and then made even worse in Citizens United. But what people don't focus on is the demand for money. Why is it that politicians need so much money? Part of it is that they are all they're all freelancing. Everyone running for Congress is trying to win in a primary or fend somebody off in a primary. If you look at countries that have stronger and more cohesive parties, such as the UK, it has its own problems, as we talk about in the book, but not on this front. Elections are so much cheaper because they're essentially doing, if you like, wholesale campaigning, not retail campaigning. If the party leadership has more control over picking the candidates, they have an incentive to pick somebody who can both win in their district and support a national program. And that's what you need to get the stronger and more accountable parties.
All right. Ian Shapiro's book with Francis McCall Rosenbluth is Responsible Parties. We'll talk more with Ian when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the American political system and how it might be improved upon. And one of the ways in which the democratic system might be improved is with a little less democracy, is the thesis of Yale political scientists Francis McCall Rosenbluth and Ian Shapiro. They've written a book that they admit right up front. This is a contrarian book. It is called Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. Ian Shapiro is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join our conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Ian, we were reflecting on this at home last night, and I stopped to think about the fact that in the early days of this country, we really didn't expect to have the people that close to the power. The Constitution certainly wasn't set up that way. We could pick the members of the House of Representatives, but the electors chose the president, and the state legislatures chose the senators. So we have put more democracy into the system over time.
Yeah, and we're not against having more democracy. We just think it's important to have the right kind of democracy. And when you say give more power to the people, you have to ask the question, which people? And if it's small groups of activists with agendas that are very different from the typical of our American voter, and they are empowered by the system of incentives we've created, then you shouldn't be surprised if the typical American voter becomes alienated and angry. Why wouldn't they? I think it's important to emphasize that politicians are not evil people. The vast majority of politicians are trying to do the best they can for the country. But politicians have to respond to the incentives in front of them. And so if we don't change the rules, we essentially give them an impossible task, because either they're going to be responsive to the small numbers of people who actually elect them in the primaries, or they're going to lose their seats. So, you know, we give them an impossible task, and then we blame them for failing at it.
So let's talk about the change. You mentioned that the Democrats changed the presidential primary rules in 1972. As George McGovern says, I opened the door to the Democratic Party, and the rest of the line is, and 20 million people left. He took a pasting in the 1972 election, and
exactly.
Yet, and nobody at that time thought that maybe they'd gone a little too far.
Well, they eventually did conclude they had gone too far, and that's when they brought in the idea, the superdelegates, as a way of trying to counteract the effects of the primaries. But this is, you know, a Band-Aid on a bad system. because the superdelegates just called up the image of the smoke-filled rooms of the past that had provoked the call for primaries in the first place. So we're not for going back to smoke-filled rooms. We are for giving the congressional parties much more of a say in the selection of candidates. Because if you think about the party leadership in Congress picking the candidates, who then pick the party leadership in Congress and back and forth, then everybody's on the same team. It's true they give a lot of power to the leadership, but only in the sense that an NFL team gives a lot of power to the quarterback and to the manager. Yeah, they have power to call the plays and to determine the strategy, but they also have enough rope to hang themselves. If they don't deliver victory, they'll be gone very quickly. So you would never get a situation where somebody like Nancy Pelosi could lead the Democrats to four successive defeats and still be the leader of her party. So we have very weak parties. They're so weak that the angry backbenchers even find it difficult to topple leaders. Same thing, the Freedom Caucus, Tea Party people in the Republican Party, you know, they thought John Boehner had completely sold out on their agenda, and subsequently Paul Ryan had, but they couldn't coordinate on an alternative, so they couldn't even knock the leadership off when they didn't like what they were doing. But the parties are so weak that it's just every person for themselves all the time. And so they do what they have to do in order to survive. As I said, they're not evil. They are trying to, they're just operating within the system of rules that we have given them.
So it seems sort of a paradox then, Ian, what you're talking about, is a stronger party would be a less ideological one, perhaps?
Yes, because if you think about if the party leadership is picking the candidates in the districts, and if the districts are more competitive. So one of our reforms is that we should stop letting state legislatures determine the districts, because they just create safe seats, which replicates the problem that the only election that matters is the primary. So we like the move towards independent commissions that you see in states like California, but the commission should draw districts that look like America. So it would be great if you, for instance, it had both rural voters and urban voters in every district, so that then the party would have to pick candidates that wouldn't just be, you know, catering to a blue city in a red state, or a rural district that has nothing to gain from worrying about urban problems. They would pick candidates that looked more like, in other words, we'd get more moderation and less compromise. Compromise sounds great, but if you're trying to get compromise between very extreme people, it's not likely going to happen, and they're going to extract all kinds of concessions for having compromise. What we want is parties that are going to see it as in their interest to converge on the kind of moderate program that most Americans favor.
Ian Shapiro, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the co-author with Francis McCall Rosenbluth of Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. I mentioned the book does talk about other countries and other systems, and it's an odd coincidence we're talking about the value of the British system on the day they're about to vote in Parliament on Brexit. But what, Ian, usually makes the British parties strong versus the ones that you see as weak in our country?
Well, since you bring it up, the phenomenon we're describing in the U.S. is not unique to the U.S. As we detail in our book, Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself, it's been going on all over the democratic world. We have chapters about Britain, France, Germany, Eastern Europe, and Latin America, and elsewhere. The British system used to be extremely functional, but the same pressures have been at work there. So you mentioned Brexit. You know, Britain had never had a referendum until 1975, also about the European Union. And here's the problem with referendums or ballot initiatives, is that it lets people think about one issue at a time without thinking about the costs of that for other things that they care about. So, for example, you can get American voters to say by 2/3 majority yes to getting rid of any tax, including the estate tax, which almost nobody pays. You know, the top multi-million dollar estates are the only people who pay a tiny percentage. But if you say, should we get rid of the estate tax if it also means getting rid of prescription drug benefits for seniors, then they say no. So what's happening there is the voter is being forced to discount their preference for the tax cut by their preference for prescription drug benefits for seniors. So this is why you get exactly this bizarre situation now in the UK, where when you extract the idea of leaving Europe and let people vote on it alone, you can get a majority for leave. But both political parties are filled with people who strongly favor not leaving, even though they were elected by the same voters. So what's going on there is the parties know that if they think about all the things their constituents care about, Brexit doesn't make sense. And so they're very resistant to it. And so government by referendum is essentially like letting a child eat as much candy as he or she wants without thinking about the stomach ache and the doctor's bills and throwing up later and so on. And so it's what parties do is that they bundle issues and they discount everything they propose by everything else they propose. And if they get it right, i.e., they do it in a way that most voters will prefer, then they win. And if they don't, they lose. And if they win, they then implement that platform of policies. And if voters like it, they get reelected. And if they don't, they don't get reelected. That's where the accountability comes. We have a system now where it's very difficult to hold anybody accountable. So look at Britain. What they did also to mess up their perfectly good system that wasn't broken, they went to direct election of party leaders. So Jeremy Corbyn, who is way to the left of the Labour Party, typical Labour Party voter, never mind typical British voter, gets elected by the membership at large. But who are these members? They like U.S. primary voters, that the people on the fringes of the Labour Party. So then the Parliamentary Labour Party had a vote of no confidence in him by 172-40. Think about that. That's a huge.
That was the
majority.
Vote against Jeremy Corbyn. It was 172-40.
Yeah, by the Parliamentary Labour Party. The membership then reelected him by 62%. So now imagine the Labour comes into office, which they may well, because Theresa May's made her own blunders. Imagine. Trying to govern when you've got a prime minister that the vast majority of his own parliamentary party cannot support if they're going to get reelected in their districts. So while the British system, as it has existed for a very long time, has been one of the best systems we've ever seen, they've also, through direct election of leaders and referenda, they've also been making it dysfunctional and alienating voters in very similar ways to what we've been doing. We have also chapters about Germany and France detailing how the same things have happened in those countries. But in each different country, you have to think about different kinds of reforms given the system that you have. But basically, they're all pushing in the same direction. We should be strengthening parties, not weakening them.
Ian Shapiro is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor of political science at Yale University, the co-author with fellow professor Francis McCall Rosenbluth of Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. You can join the conversation on the exchange. A lot of interest in how the political systems function or don't in the world at large today. 800-838-3760 for your thoughts by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from Patricia Ann in Eureka, who wants to ask you about instant runoff voting or ranked choice voting and what you think about that, mm-hmm. Ian.
Again, we think that is the it's kind of a Band-Aid on a bad system. Basically, what that tends to do, again, is weaken the accountability, because what happens with ranked choice voting is you tend to keep more candidates in. In France, they have single-member district systems like we have. So one candidate gets elected per constituency, just like we do and the British do. But they have two rounds, which is the same thing as runoff voting. And so what happens is they get lots of smaller parties. You get lots of smaller parties, you end up having coalition governments, and again, nobody knows who to hold accountable because everybody blames everybody else in the coalition for what happens. So if you have instant runoff voting, you're going to have multiple candidates in our system promising to bring goodies. We'll bring more goodies back to the constituency than you will. And you'll get a lot of pork barrel politics and that kind of thing. Rather, what's needed is a party that functions more like a team, where everybody's pulling in the same direction.
So essentially, what you're talking about is it's almost like nationalizing the political system. But hasn't that happened? I mean, we had the Gingrich contract with America in 1994 that really sort of nationalized congressional politics at that time. And then, you know, all the calls in the 2018 election to people who said you should just go out and vote mindlessly for Democrats just to provide a check on Donald Trump.
What we've seen is not a nationalizing of the election. What we've seen is a hijacking of the political parties by their fringes. So even though they operate nationally, they're not representative of the national median voter. The typical voter is not the person to whom parties are catering. For the most part, they're catering either to local interests or to the voters and the activists at the extremes of both parties. That's the real problem. It's a hijacking problem, not a national problem.
Let's come to the protection of minorities that you deal with in the book, because this is really interesting. Amendments to the Constitution after the Civil War were meant to protect minorities in the South, and instead we got Jim Crow laws and lynching. What went wrong?
Well, we had extremely high levels of racism, and nothing was going to change until that began to change. But it's interesting that you bring up that subject, because one of the things we've seen in recent decades has been the call for more so-called descriptive representation, getting candidates getting more minority candidates into Congress and so on. And so what that has produced has been majority-minority districts, where people draw districts with a majority of minority voters in them to get minority candidates into Congress. There's a huge cost to that, which is that, again, you get districts that are all safe seats and that don't look like America. And so you make it harder for the parties to govern, because everything's going to be resolved in the primaries. So it's another thing that's contributed to the primaries. And it's worth pointing out, by the way, that if you look at the two biggest legislative achievements for minority voters, they were the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, both of which were enacted before the advent of majority-minority districts. And if you ask what major legislative gains have African-Americans made since the institution of majority-minority districts, you'd be hard-pressed to come up with anything. And this is because the African-American voters now are not the two parties, for the most part, don't compete for them.
In fact, you say that racial politics in the United States figure in what you say is little electoral drag on the poll to the right.
Exactly, because the incentive of the Democrats is largely to ignore African Americans, because most African Americans are in very safe Democratic seats, at least where we've drawn majority-minority districts. And the only incentive Republicans have is to repress African-American turnout. So, far from benefiting from these changes, we have more African-Americans from the South in particular in Congress than we had 25 years ago. And that is a great thing. But if it's not producing policies that benefit African Americans, it's something of a hollow victory.
We'll come back and talk more with Ian Shapiro. He is the co-author with his partner at the political science program at Yale University, Francis McCall Rosenbluth, in co-authoring Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. They admit right up front, this is a contrarian book. It's going very much against the grain of getting more democratic processes involved in choosing candidates for office and choosing them who's going to run for the offices in the first place. We've talked about the primary system and how that has changed so greatly in the country. There's lots to talk about yet. You may join the conversation by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking politics with Ian Shapiro, who's a professor of political science at Yale University. He and fellow professor Francis McCall Rosenbluth wrote Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. The general argument is that by democratizing the process of primaries, we have made them too responsive to activist groups and therefore weakened the central political parties and dragged them off in different ideological directions. You can join the conversation on the exchange. It is about more than just the United States by far. 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Ian, we have an email here from Dale, no town given. Dale writes, I vaguely remember a TED talk about the Leroy election. The thesis was that candidates are elected by the number of people named Leroy, arguing that very few people participate in primaries. And in fact, I know that in Oregon with a closed primary system, there's often a complaint that that people don't get to vote in primaries, but they also don't register for parties to be able to do so.
I think that's all true. I think most people are disgusted with the whole process. By the way, I would also say that the primaries are partly responsible for low turnout in the general election, because if you know that the result is not in question, why bother showing up? And particularly if you don't like the candidate that has been chosen in the primary in the first place. So if we made primaries less important, for example, by saying we could have a rule which said if the turnout in the primary is less than 75% of the turnout in the previous general election, the result would be ignored and the party in Congress would pick the candidate. Then you would de-emphasize the importance of primaries and you would start to get the sorts of candidates selected that people would feel more enthusiastic about coming out to vote for.
You really think that would happen? Because people feel, you know, there's a certain level of like, gee, I had nothing to do with picking the people who got in the general election, so why should I vote now for the people who are not registered by party in Oregon, for example? I mean, so would they feel any more strongly about voting for people that they had nobody to do with picking in the primary season?
Well, I think they would look at what the people ran on and what they were, you know, if you have a situation where, you know, Republican candidates are just running on gun rights and Democratic candidates are running on transgender bathrooms, most voters are going to say, well, you know, fine, but this is not what makes me want to go to vote at the polls. If the candidates were running on fixing public schools and resolving the stalemates on health care and so forth, things that most Americans actually care deeply about and are worried about, you would start to see them wanting to show up and listen and debate the policies that were being proposed and vote for and against. But that's not where we are. We're in this world in which the activists who have different agendas are the ones that are picking the candidates. And so we have to somehow, lance that boil.
Another email here from Len in Ashland, who writes to ask if you have considered, one, compulsory voting to ensure the activist minority doesn't dominate, and two, a portion of the legislature being chosen by lot, as the ancient Greeks did, because the average citizen is more moderate than the activist party member. That, again, from Len in Ashland.
So I'll tell you, there's a joke about a traveler who goes up to a farmer in Donegal in Ireland and says, how do I get to Dublin? And the answer comes back, well, I wouldn't start out from here, Sonny. So I like both those ideas, but we are in the business of trying to have an effect with this book. And I think that, you know, compulsory voting, if you look at countries like Australia that have it, it does tend to mitigate the pathology that I'm talking about here somewhat, although they don't have big penalties. It's hard to have big penalties for not voting. But it does increase turnout pretty substantially, and that would be a good thing. It seems as such a tough political sell in the U.S. that we didn't actually go there in our book. But sure, it certainly wouldn't do any harm. Likewise, with election by lot, if you have election by lot, you would get more of a random distribution of voters. But the extremely powerful attachment that we have to geographically based constituencies seems, again, to make it a very tough sell. But it is a big problem in democracies, because what makes the system work is if the constituencies look more like the country. So it would be much better, rather than having rural constituencies and urban constituencies, if all constituencies had some rural voters and some urban voters. Big problem, by the way, in the UK, because London is so prosperous, but the north of England has a per capita income below Mississippi's. So again, you know, they would be better off if every constituency in Britain had a sliver of London in it. Again, you'd start to have politicians running who would be thinking both about the financial problems of the City of London and the deindustrialization of the northern cities. Random selection would be great. Short of that, our proposal for Britain is to draw much bigger constituencies. They have, you know, it's a more feasible route to the same goal. So that's how we've been thinking. We really want to propose feasible solutions.
But in either country, you're talking about very long and slender districts, I would think, to be able to get enough people from the big cities and rural representation in a single district.
Well, that's true. But if you think about, I come from Connecticut, which is basically completely, you know, the whole congressional delegation is Democrats, because the districts have been drawn around the three biggest cities. It would be much better to have the districts be more competitive by having larger percentages of non-urban voters in those districts. It wouldn't necessarily matter if the Democrats won all the seats once some of the time, but what matters is, you know, at most one seat in Connecticut is actually competitive between the two parties. That's what we need to get away from. And it certainly would be possible to make many more of the districts in America competitive by sort of flower petal-shaped districts around cities that included more rural voters in them, or at least ex-urban voters in them, so that you can't win just by creating to the urban core, or you can't win just by creating to the rural core. You couldn't do it everywhere, obviously, but you could do it in a very large number of constituencies, and we could certainly get from a world if you did some of that and you stopped doing the majority-minority districts and you used independent commissions rather than state legislatures, which just create safe seats for the party currently in charge, you could get back to a world in which, you know, at least half of the constituencies were genuinely competitive between the parties, which would be an enormous improvement on the current system where 90% of the districts are uncompetitive.
There are several chapters in the book, as we pointed out, on other countries with the Labradoodle versus Poodledore crossbreeding you mentioned early in the book, where you're trying for one thing, but you get something quite other. I mean, have many countries made adjustments to their political systems and ultimately hated what they got?
This dynamic has gone on in many countries. I think I mentioned to you the UK already. But if you look at Germany was held out as the perfect labradoodle because it was they have proportional representation, so they get lots of parties. But they also have single-member districts, so that strength it reduces the number of parties. And they had pretty predictable coalitions, so it functioned like a two-party system in some ways. But what's gone on in Germany, that's gone on elsewhere in Europe, is with the collapse, you know, we've seen the collapse of trade unions and the left everywhere, and this has led to fragmentation of the left. So now we have the Der Linke party, the far-left party, we have the Greens, and we have the Social Democrats, and then we've got fragmentation on the right as well. The Alternative for Deutschland, which is a kind of right-wing ultra-nationalist party. And so it took Angela Merkel this last time 7 months to put together a coalition, and it's now extremely unpopular. And the only reason she's so unpopular that she's been forced out of the leadership at the end of her term. And the only reason they're not calling an election is that they're afraid that the Alternative for Deutschland would win even more. But they've done very similar things to what we've done. You know, the SPD, the left party, now gives huge power to the membership, which is on its fringes, and that immobilizes its leaders. And so you're seeing a lot of the same dysfunctionalist impulses playing out. They play out differently because they have different rules. But it's basically the same problem. It's this misdiagnosis. It's the idea if you give more grassroots control to party members, you'll get more accountability, and it ignores the fact that the people who get that control tend to be highly unrepresentative of German voters.
So now the
German government is getting hammered in regional elections in Hesse and Bavaria and so on.
Oh, that's right. They have to have some major losses there.
Yeah,
There's a
yeah.
portion early in the book, though, where you mention Geert Wilders, who's very right-wing in the Netherlands, and Benjamin Netanyahu in the same sentence. I mean, what do you see that they bear in common?
All these right-wing parties are beneficiaries of the collapse of organized labor. So, you know, it used 25 years ago, the Labor Party, the left-of-center party in all of those systems would come in first or second. Now they come in fourth or fifth. And you've had this fragmenting of parties because the proportional representation makes it easy for small parties to survive. And it's in a way back to the 1930s. You know, Britain has a two-party system because they have single-member districts. In the 1930s, there was a fascist party in Britain with 50,000 voters, actually at one point more voters than the Nazis, but they couldn't get anywhere because of the two-party system. Germany had a multi-party system, and so the Nazis could get a foothold in the parliament. Same thing with the fascists in Italy. And we're looking at the same thing again now. The saving grace of the British system is that UKIP and the British National Party never got any seats. UKIP, you know, got one or two seats. In PR, they would have had 90 to 100 seats and be a powerful force in the British legislature, just as Wilders and his crowd do in Holland and the AfD do in Germany and the ultra-right-wing parties do in Israel. So these ultra-nationalist right-wing parties are the beneficiaries of the fragmentation of the party system and the weakening of the party system that we're arguing against.
So if you do get to the kind of strengthening that you and Francis envision in the book, people feel like the activists don't have as much control, do you gain the middle back, though, necessarily, or do they just tune out because they feel like, things are okay? In other words, does less power equal less interest?
Well, people say, you know, the trouble in if you have two parties converging on the median voter, it's a Tweedledum, Tweedledee problem, and everybody gets bored with politics. But that's not really right, because if you look at what happens, is there are some issues where both parties converge on the same proposal, like Social Security and Medicare. And the reason is they're hugely popular with most voters. But there are many, many areas where the parties disagree because people are not sure what will be best. And so you'll get, you know, the left of center party will propose spending during recessions to get out of them. The right of center party will propose tax cuts to get out of recessions. In Britain, the left of center party will nationalize the railways. The right of center party will denationalize the railways. So there's, in fact, a lot to fight over in politics just because there's always ideological disagreement and there's always a disagreement about what works. And democracy is all about allowing experimentation on those fronts. So, you can overstate the Tweedledum, Tweedledee problem. The thing the parties really converge on are the things they know most voters want.
All right. So we will see if anybody takes up the recommendations in the book. It is called Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. It's the work of Francis McCall Rosenbluth and Ian Shapiro, both political scientists at Yale University. Ian has been our guest today. Thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.